I hope is a bit of paper that is just a summary of the headings and a few key points within my address, and on the back page is a picture, and some of us prefer pictures to words. Well, it's a picture with words that may or may not be helpful. Ultimately, we won't have the addresses as in the past in a box, all 17 pages, and you take it away. We're going to post it online. This is not only about saving costs, this is also in small ways attempting to say we are serious as a diocese about aspects of responding to climate change, which is a motion coming up later in our synod. So, introduction. Why are we here in this place at this time for the purpose of doing the business of the Diocese of Christchurch? The answer lies in our gospel reading last night from Luke chapter 5. God in Jesus Christ has called you and me, the church, into being and given us a task to do to draw more and more people into the church, into God's family. In the Christian movement, Jesus catalyzed into life and growth through history. There are moments when we pause to take stock. Some of those moments are captured in the New Testament epistles. For example, our passage last night from Colossians chapter 1. Paul and other writers of the epistles take stock. Is the church on track? Is it focused on Jesus Christ? Has it lost sight of Jesus through distractions? Why is it allowing itself to be divided? Does the church grasp the big picture of what God is doing in the world? Every synod is a pause in the life of a diocese. It's time to ask questions of ourselves. But the questions are not primarily about whether the statistics on page 30 of the reports contain an error of data compilation. The questions are, or ought to be, primarily about our life in Christ. Christ is the foundation of the diocese, the inspiration for what we do, and the end towards whom we travel in this life as successors to those he first called from their fishing nets. In our synod, our reports and bills and motions, as I read them, are properly about a diocese taking a moment to pause, to review, to take stock, to ask whether we are heading in the right direction. The direction that is, which is faithful to the call of Jesus to fish for people, in the direction which is never satisfied until we see the fullness of the life of the kingdom of God. So my address to you is part of the pausing to reflect on where we are going. And it's an opportunity for me to share with you my vision for the future and propose strategic themes as I lead you, having been called by God through you to be your bishop. And it is a great privilege to be here with you for this first synod after becoming your bishop. Part A, the Diocese of Christchurch, 2018 to 2019. I want to begin this part of the address by saying thank you. Praise and thanks to God who has called us into being as a diocese and who continues to work among us and with us. Through God, we have been blessed in the past year in many ways, for which we give God thanks. But it's also appropriate to offer our human thanks to our peers and colleagues who have done so much for us. So on behalf of the diocese, I thank Archbishop Philip Richardson for his superb leadership as our pro tem bishop from early May 2018 until my ordination and installation on the 9th of February this year. And alongside him were Helen Rowd, our Vicar General, and Peter Hurricks, our Episcopal Commissary. Thank you, Helen and Peter, for all you did to ensure Episcopal oversight and ordering of our life was well exercised during the interim period under Philip's leadership. I also thank, on behalf of the diocese, the many people, clerical and lay, paid and unpaid, elected or appointed, who have worked so hard over the past year and who make the Diocese of Christchurch what it is. The list is extensive. It's readily found across the pages of our diocesan prayer cycle. And I hope we are praying for each other with thanksgiving across each Sunday of the year and each day of the month. I work more closely with some on the list than others. There are more than a dozen names in this category, and I will not list you all today, partly because I'm worried that I'll miss the 13th person out. But you know who you are. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I also warmly thank the following people who are leaving one of our three major boards in the diocese. The three major boards, to me, as I've experiencing them, and I've never been on any of them before, Anglican Care, CPT and Standing Committee, involve an extraordinary amount of work and dedication on behalf of us all. So from CPT, Wayne Hart, Roger Sutton and Roger Bridge. Anglican Care, the Reverend Katrina Hill. Standing Committee, Judith McKenzie, the Reverend Matthew Ling and Lindsay Sturge. Thank you for your work on our behalf. Perhaps we could give them a round of applause. There is a sense in which some things I would prefer not to talk about in a quick review of the past year, but I think that would be an avoidance of things that have been real in our life and in our history. So disaffiliation. The past year since we last met as a synod has been a year in which the ordinary mission and mission of God's faithful people in our diocese has been overshadowed by a tear in the fabric of our fellowship. Consequential on the decision of General Synod Te Hanauta Whānui 2018 to permit the blessing of same-sex civil marriages, when we met in September 2018, we knew that virtually all the congregations of three parishes and a significant portion of a fourth parish, along with their clergy, and one or two others were disaffiliating from our diocese. Since then, other clergy and members of congregations have left us. By my count, 9 new churches have been formed within our diocesan boundaries, coalescing with at least 3 other churches in the South and North Islands into a new diocese of some dozen churches with a soon-to-be-ordained Bishop J.B. in. What is it in the waters of Canterbury which has led to the predominance of Canterbury churches in this new venture? I know that across our diocese, these disaffiliations have resulted in pain, anger, confusion and distress. There have been consequences on multiple levels of our life together. However, as God's people, we are always called to hope, to faith and to love. And even amidst the pain of these 12 months past, there has been hope, faith and love. Sometimes faint, often strong. We have seen creative and courageous efforts made to rebuild congregational life. There has been determination that quota will continue to be paid. There have been unsung heroes among clergy and lay leaders in affected ministry units. I salute you and thank you for your faithfulness and your vision for the future of your parishes. Nevertheless, we have lost something that will be very hard to regain. A significant portion of Anglicans aged under 60 years have disaffiliated. We need to reflect very carefully on this fact of our life together. That is, that when sociologists tell us that most younger generations in New Zealand are liberal-minded on the matter which has divided our church, the largest portion of younger generations in our diocese have not reflected society at large. Younger Christians actively involved in congregational life in the 21st century are predominantly conservative in theological and ethical outlook. If, as a diocese, we ignore this observation, we do so at our peril. Recovery. Immense work has been undertaken on the reinstatement of the cathedral in the square. Significant progress has been made on the recovery program as a whole, including the opening of All Saints, Merivale, St Albans. And generally, our property portfolio is changing as some post-quake rationalisation of churches takes place. This past year has seen, for instance, St Anne's, St Martin's, St James, Lower Riccarton and St John's, Bishopdale, put up for sale. And there may be more, but they're the three I could remember. At other moments in our synod timetable, we will have time to consider various matters to do with the cathedral reinstatement and our recovery program. But here I want to acknowledge the hard work CPT, parishes, CCRL and CCRT staff, vestries and board members have put into making things happen, including raising much needed funds for work to proceed. Thank you everyone. Property and mission. In our synod, we have a few motions concerning assets, especially property in relation to our participation in the mission of God. I see these motions as representing some frustration, some dreaming, and some aspirations to be better resourced in our gospel mission. I hear, as you likely do also, some talk about how we might better deploy assets across our diocese for a better focused mission. However, I feel as your bishop that I need to say that it is important that we have an accurate understanding of the situation we are in. A diocese is a network of parishes and other ministry units such as schools and chaplaincies, each focused on a specific local ministry. Most parishes have a local ministry to their neighbourhood. Our schools have a local ministry to their students, staff and parental community. Each parish has some kind of asset such as a church, hall and vicarage held in trust by CPT. Each school owns its own assets, not owned by CPT for the most part. Chaplaincies and hospitals, prisons and military establishments have no assets attached to them. The diocese in its own right has very few assets. That is, better deployment of assets across our diocese for a better focused mission is in the hands of our parishes. There is no Diocese of Christchurch which can force Parish A to give up a surplus asset so that Parish B can be better resourced. We can agree, however, via Synod, to voluntarily give up some of our assets for a common pool, e.g. for planting new churches in new neighbourhoods, or for a particular project, as some parishes most generously did in order for the transitional cathedral to be paid for. Or, we should note, Parish A does not need to wait for Synod. It can give away assets because it sees the possibilities for flourishing in Parish B. The single most powerful signal of a change in the deployment of assets would be initiatives taken by individual parishes to give away surplus assets in order to develop focused strategic mission in another part of the diocese. But let's be open and honest with ourselves about how likely such a generous, helpful outcome is to happen. This past year, many parishes have sought to use their assets to support, sustain, and develop the mission to which God has called them in their local neighbourhoods. In a couple of instances, I'm pleased to report, there have been signals that gifting is going to take place. But for the most part, most parishes are pretty desperate to use what is at hand, feeling that any surplus available to themselves is desperately needed for their local mission, rather than available to be gifted away. There is one other aspect of property which I want to comment on. This is a situation when a parish wants to spend down assets otherwise set aside for maintenance of buildings or for the purchase of a vicarage. On the one hand, CPT has an obligation to protect those assets on the basis that its knowledge of 163 years of property matters tells trustees and staff that there always comes a future point when funds are needed by parishes for the development of its buildings. On the other hand, parishes have an obligation to forward the proclamation of the gospel and the building of the kingdom of God. The tension we experience between these two obligations is as predictable as it is also healthy. In my view, this tension is resolvable through communication which leads to understanding of the importance of our respective obligations between CPT and parishes. But also critical is the role the Synod plays. We set guidelines and rules, for example, about things such as vicarages. We cannot set rules as a Synod which shape Standing Committee and CPT responses to parish requests and then demur when the response is not to our liking. Excitement and faithfulness. Notwithstanding difficulties and dilemmas touched on in my paragraphs above, there is much happening in the diocese to be excited by. One of the most exciting experiences of the past year for me has been the multiple ways in which lay and clerical leaders have stepped up to lead their congregations in worship, together reaching out in ministry and mission to the community which surrounds their ministry units. There are many stories across our diocese of effective mission taking place, of growth in congregational life, of things happening which excite and enthuse our lay and clerical leaders, and excite and enthuse me when I hear about them. A huge number of people in our diocese quietly get on with the tasks God has assigned to you. It is a privilege to meet so many of you, to talk about what is happening among you under God, and then as bishop to go away knowing that the work continues faithfully because of your responsibility and dedication to the work of Christ in the world. In that sense, maybe we could give ourselves a round of applause right now. Thank you. It's sometimes observed, as we get to Part B, the Diocese of Christchurch and its surrounding world, that one of the things that the mainstream churches in the life of New Zealand have lost in the last few decades is a sense of engagement with the public life of the nation and of the world. We've lost public theology, it's said. We've lost committees that used to exist to make statements and support bishops and other leaders pronouncing on issues of the day. I'm not sure that we'll ever get that day back, but I think it is relevant and I hope helpful for me to make a few observations as bishop about our diocese and its surrounding world. It is a truism to observe, once again, that the Diocese of Christchurch exists in a surrounding world. But it is an important and relevant truth. Tragically, this truth was brought home to us on the 15th of March this year, when terrorism struck our city and killed fellow citizens who could as easily have been you and me if the terrorist had been slightly differently motivated. The state of the global economy is affecting investment returns on funds held in trust on behalf of ministry units by the CPT. Rising sea levels due to climate change will affect the eastern seaboard of our diocese in particular, though I realise in writing that sentence I should mention the western seaboard as well. Sorry, Hokitika and Westland parishes. Especially in terms of population density, the eastern suburbs of Christchurch City are likely to be most affected by these rising sea levels. Climate change is affected by pollution and by the amount of trees consuming carbon dioxide. In recent weeks, we've been alarmed at the extent of burning forests in the Amazon catchment. Did you know that one reason for burning forests in that part of Brazil is to increase the amount of land available to grow soybeans? That China is very keen on these soybeans. And the reason for their keenness are the tariffs on US soybeans being imposed by President Trump. No one on the eastern seaboard of the diocese gets to vote for or against Trump and his crazy economics. But when he sneezes, he increases the chance that we catch cold here in a land far away. A correspondent this week observed to me in an email, "The more I talk and work on the issue of caring for our planet, the more I hear people are worried and don't know where to turn. We must reckon with this anxiety as part of the context for our mission." I am glad to say that that same correspondent went on to talk about how it made him more and more wanting to turn to his own Christian faith as part of a response to this anxiety. Not only Trump, but other global politicians are ratcheting up rhetoric which divides humanity. When polarised humanity intersects with economic slump, global conflict is close at hand. That is a lesson from the 1930s. Last Sunday, the 1st of September 2019, was the 80th anniversary of the beginning of World War II. Many people still alive remember the 1st of September 1939. We have no excuse on our globe for forgetfulness. Tragically, we are in the grip of a political aspiration which intends to divide one human from another and to risk the well-being of people through creating chaos in marketplaces. This, we should be clear, is against the spirit of the gospel. A theologian, Monsieur, once profoundly observed, actually in the 1930s and 1934, this: fundamentally, the gospel is obsessed with the idea of the unity of human society. Fundamentally, the gospel is obsessed with the idea of the unity of human society. We, in this day and age, should be very, very clear that things which divide one human from another, whether it's terrorism or economic chaos or just generally trying to grab the wheels of power by stirring up a nation, these things are not Christian. These things are not part of the gospel of Jesus Christ. In the world surrounding the Diocese of Christchurch, where divisive forces are at work, we have opportunity to witness to the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ by always working for unity, among ourselves, in our local communities, in our nation and in the world. And of course, we have no witness if we are divided amongst ourselves as a church. Justice is integral to genuine unity. To work for unity in society is necessarily to work for justice. That is to work for right and fair relationships between people. As Christians, we are all responsible for this work, for it is the work of the kingdom of God. But in our diocese, we are blessed to have an extra dimension to such work through the faithful work of Anglican Care. This past year has seen significant change to Anglican Care's operations and to the structure of the leadership of Anglican Care. New directions are emerging under the leadership of Roger Sutton, Matthew Mark, and Patrick Murray. There is no person who engages with one or more of the outreaches of Anglican Care who is not a victim to one degree or another of the outworking of global forces in the world which surrounds us. Every person we engage with through such ministries, whether it's through Anglican Care or our own local neighbourhood outreaches, every person is our opportunity to be obsessed with the unity of human society, to be obsessed with the bringing of the reconciling ministry of Jesus Christ to the lives of the last, the least, and the lost in our midst. I'm going to take my watch off because as we come to part C, that's the longest section of the address, and we better make sure that in caring for you as the least, the last, and the lost, you get fed at morning tea at the right time. Part C, the regeneration of the Diocese of Christchurch. Now, quite a bit of what I'm going to say you will have heard last night in Spanky's sermon. That's because Spanky and I sing from the same hymn sheet, with the exception of our own personal life stories, which illustrate our sermons. Introduction. What kind of a diocese will we be in 2030? Spanky quite rightly said, so what would it be like to be 30 years hence? I will draw that back to 11 years hence this morning. What kind of a diocese will we be in 2030? Asking that kind of question helps us to determine what we do in the years between now and 2030. What kind of a diocese could we be in 2030? We could be healthy, happy, and harmonious, and we should be, but that is a bit general. My vision, to be a little more specific, is that we are a regenerated diocese, a diocese regenerated through Christ. That's why on the back sheet of your, the back page of your summary bit of paper, regeneration through Christ is the centrepiece of the diagram. Our statistics about decline in attendance, decline in baptisms, confirmations, weddings and funerals are well known to us as synod members. On one table of attendance, 2014, 15, 16 and 17, our total attendance as listed in our statistical returns in round terms are 356,000, 351,000, 316,000. Maybe that was a blip because 2017 was 336,000. Those statistics keep dropping. They're way worse for last year, but I'm not including those because our data collection is a bit incomplete for last year, and obviously also it was a year affected by disaffiliations. Here's another smaller kind of statistic, but I think also bringing home a reality for us. Around 5 years ago, there were four young adult evening services in parishes in Christchurch City, in parishes which have not subsequently experienced disaffiliation or major disaffiliation. Today, there is one such service. So in 5 years, on one benchmark of connection to younger generations, we've dropped from four to one. Statistics are one thing. Another is what we see with our eyes. I see, as I go around the parishes, a diocese which is dominated numerically by participants aged over 60 years. I think, though I actually see lots of younger people in the synod, so I'm very glad about that. I think our synod tends to represent that domination in numbers. My vision is that in 2030, our eyes will tell us that the majority of our worshippers are aged under 60 years. My vision is that in 2030, our statistics will tell us that we are growing again as a diocese. My vision is that in 2030, our testimonies will tell us that we have rediscovered ourselves as Te Hahi Mihinare, the missionary church. The alternative in 2030 is that our eyes, our statistics, and our hearts will tell us that we are about to die. You do not want that. I do not want that. We do not want that future. The focus on regeneration that I'm putting to you is because we are missing generations in many parishes. We're missing children. We're missing youth. We're missing young adults. And we're missing middle-aged folk, if I can define them as 40 to 60-year-olds. I just scrape in at the moment. What are we to do if we're to be regenerated as a diocese? To be a praying diocese would be an important first step. Only God, in the end, can regenerate us. Only God can turn people's hearts to the living Christ. Our regeneration must be through Christ, first and foremost, not through smart plans and great engagement with digital media and so forth. They will be important, but first of all, our regeneration must be through Christ. To be a thinking diocese would be an important second step. Thinking, that is, about what it means to be Anglican missionaries. Thinking about what message we are communicating to our neighbourhoods. A great challenge is to think about what it is that is good in today's world about our news about Jesus. A world in which many people are completely disinterested in our news, whether or not we think and keep saying it's good news. In the context we live in today, people are disinterested even before they get to the possibility that they would hear our news as good news. But this challenge is the challenge which the church has always faced with the gospel. With what language will we proclaim it? We do not have a New Testament in Aramaic because fairly quickly after Jesus ascended, the church, as it spread the gospel, spread it in Greek and not Aramaic. With what emphases will we convey the message of God's saving love for a world which has lost its way? Again, if we read our New Testament and contrast Matthew, Mark, and Luke with John's gospel, with what we read in the epistles of Paul, with what we might read in the book of Hebrews, we see the early Christians pushing hard on different emphases within the one good news of Jesus Christ. What is it that we need to push hard on in the next 11 years? Another challenge is to think robustly about whether our message, our claim that we have good news, is institutionally ethical, socially viable, personally effective, intellectually plausible. In the 21st century, we need all four aspects of our message about Jesus Christ to be in harmony with one another. That is, that when we say, we have good news for you about Jesus, people look at us and say, okay, I see where you're coming from. It's from an ethically good institution. I see that if I respond to this message, I will join a good, socially viable network of people. I hear from you that Jesus is making a difference in your life. It's personally effective, this good news. And it's intellectually plausible. It makes sense in some way. And it's not difficult to recognise that in various ways, the world outside the church thinks at certain points, depending on certain headlines or certain engagements with us, that we are not institutionally ethical, that we are socially a bit weird, that we may not have a lot of talk about how Jesus is making a difference to our lives, and it's not intellectually plausible to believe in a sky theory, to pick up one phrase of attack on the gospel these days that I often come across. Historically, the Anglican Church has a good track record of being a gospel church which is institutionally ethical, socially viable, personally effective, and intellectually plausible. But in the 21st century, we cannot rest on our laurels of the 18th, 19th, and even 20th centuries. Thirdly, to be a changing diocese would be an important third step, to actually have some change in our diocese. Talk of regeneration is not about saving the Anglican Club from closure. It's about rediscovering our purpose as New Zealand's missionary church. But here's the thing. Mostly, in my experience, we Anglicans do not think of ourselves as a missionary church. If we are to think of ourselves in that way, it would be a cultural change for many of us, and cultural changes are hard to make. Our cultural tendency as Anglicans is to look in on ourselves, to preserve what has been our way of doing things, and to focus on the needs of those who currently come to church. The cultural change we need is to think about church being for those who do not currently attend, and to let the past go in order to reach out to those around us. There is talk around the diocese about strategy and what is the strategic plan which will guide us forward. But a wise person has said, culture eats strategy for breakfast. That is, culture, or the way we do things in our ministry units, all too often kills any and every strategic plan. Let me put that more positively. Where we have seen change in the diocese in the years since the quakes, we have seen people open to changing the way they do things, open to change a parish culture in order to be a different kind of parish. And in particular, and most obviously, that has happened where parishes have actually changed enough to merge together. It is not easy to change culture in our parishes and other ministry units, but it can be done. We can be a different diocese in 2030. We see the gifts God has given us, along with our passion and commitment for the church. We actually have everything in our church, in our diocese, to see renewal come. And we have the ability to put together a strategic new direction and make it happen. The question perhaps is this: are we willing to do things differently? Can we see the culture of our ministry unit changing? The difficulty with those questions, I find, is that many of us Anglicans eagerly say yes to such a question, and 5 years later, things are just the same. What that means is that culture is deep-rooted in each of us, and that we do not understand the inordinate capacity of culture to kill strategy before it is birthed. Ruthless honesty about the way we are doing things, and whether that way is inhibiting the gospel, will bring a lot more change than if the bishop or ministry educator or archdeacon tells us what to do according to a detailed strategic plan. It has been said to me that good ecclesiology is a commitment to reality no matter what the cost. Good ecclesiology, the best church we can be, starts with a commitment to how things actually are, no matter what the cost of facing that reality. So we can and will regenerate ourselves if we reform our culture, if the way we do things around here changes, so that new generations of Anglicans find their home in our diocese. And fourthly, we can be a regenerated diocese in 2030 if we make it cool to talk about evangelism. If we recognise that the path to regeneration is through spiritual regeneration, conversion of people to Jesus Christ. That's talk which Anglicans are not always so keen on. We like the thought that we'll grow the church because people will kind of drift in almost anonymous and unseen ways, bit by bit, and over a couple of years will increase from 30 to 40 because somehow people on some sort of spiritual journey come into our doors. That is where some people are at, and that is real and good when it happens. But I think as a gospel people, we can have a higher ambition to see people who are engaged by Jesus Christ and their lives turned around, and in that conversion, wanting to meet together with God's people in ways which are not anonymous. They may be quite lively and loud and uncomfortable for us, but that is what being a missionary church would involve. Strategy, goal, and vision. I want to talk about a vision and key themes to guide us towards regeneration. A strategic vision. What is my vision for the Diocese of Christchurch in 2030? One advantage of Spanky naming 2049 is that he said he'd be 70. Where are you, Spanky? You're there. Right, that's right. You'll be 70. So you'll still be alive in 2049. I'm not going to tell you how old I'll be in 2049. I've got some reasons, along with my life insurer, to doubt that I will still be there to see it. So I'm focused on the more modest target of 2030. Here is a snapshot. A diocese in which God is glorified and the gospel is proclaimed vibrantly in word and in deed, with its churches, all the churches, though likely fewer in number than we have today, full on Sundays, with every generation represented in the congregations. We must have, I believe, a big vision in which we see all of our ministry units being regenerated. I'm not satisfied with the thought that, well, maybe 10 of the 60 will be regenerated in 2030. Let's aspire for every one of our ministry units to be regenerated with every generation represented. And our multi-purpose buildings are busy Tuesdays to Saturdays with community-serving activities and spiritual growth through Bible study and fellowship groups. Our cathedral in the square, which we will be back in, is barely big enough for regular diocesan youth services and other major events. Theology House, which currently has a staff of a half-time director and part-time staff workers supporting that work, a vision that it has a staff of two full-time theologians, one of whom is a leading advocate for social, political, and community issues of the day, that readdressing, that refining of our voice in the public marketplace. There are several Anglican congregations in this vision in Christchurch City, which no one is sure about where they meet because they keep moving, but Facebook version 3.0 or its successor keeps the networks informed. What would help us to know that the vision was becoming a reality through the 2020s? We should set a strategic, measurable goal, and this is my proposal for a strategic goal, that the regeneration of the diocese from 2019 to 2030 is measured by attendance numbers and by age profile of the diocese, with reference to specific age surveys for the years 2020, 2025, and 2030. I love anecdotes, I love stories, I love testimonies of what God's doing among us. But the danger with anecdata, is that it shields us from the actual reality that statistical data would tell us about how well we're doing. So I'm proposing that in 3 years of the next 11, we do some work. It will cost us a bit of money to say, how actually are we doing? If we do an age survey next year in 2020, would 2025 show that we are actually making progress towards the goal I am setting? I want to also say that if our surveys measure failure, then we at least have tried to achieve something. I would rather be a failure on the score than be the bishop who is scared to fail. As we make our way through the next decade or so, what strategic emphases will be important? I suggest it is now time to move on from talking about Christ-centered mission, raising up young leaders, and faithful stewardship. Though not because any of these three values are no longer important. They remain important. But we need some refreshment and refocusing. So I want to introduce three strategic themes that the clergy have heard me talk about this year. And I encourage you to stay awake through the next 12 minutes, not least because if anyone falls asleep in the synod, including me, you will become a synod bingo item. I have been informed. Right, strategic themes. Focusing on disciples, families, and communities. If you take 8 words away from today, please take these 8 words. Regeneration through making disciples, supporting families, strengthening communities. And if 8 words is too much for you, just 4 words. Regeneration, disciples, families, communities. When you're back in your parishes on Sunday and the vicar says, Mary, summarise what happened in Synod. If you can get those 4 words to your parish, I'll be mightily pleased. What do I mean when talking about disciples, families and communities? Disciples. Disciples making disciples who make disciples. The sense of multiplication through reaching out and seeing people come to Christ, but seeing them also grow in Christ, but in their growth in Christ, further reaching out to bring more people to Christ. Presupposed here is an importance of defining Christians in the 21st century as people who follow Jesus Christ in their daily lives. This theme includes the following aspects of discipling and discipleship. Attending to children, to youth, young adults, to new Christians, including what we call deeper camp, the Eco Monastery, Crecio, the Growing Disciples program being run this year by the Macmillans, building on Phil Trotter's work. This theme includes a shift in thinking about church from some kind of static institution to being a movement. This theme includes church thinking of itself as a house of prayer and a teaching space. Disciples making disciples who make disciples includes our work in schools and universities. It's critical to the future or next generation of leaders. It incorporates our commitment to world mission that we will talk about later today. It incorporates nurture through ministries of word and sacrament that are at the heart of our worshipping life as Anglicans. And this theme includes facing the fact that being a disciple is costly, in obedience, in standing out from the world, and its pressures to conform, in faithfulness over the long haul of life. And it includes being a disciple is about growing into Christ's likeness. Families. Families is about growing children, youth, young adults, and includes middle-aged and older persons celebrated and supported by the whole church family. Family is understood here as an elastic term in today's context. I've also thought about whānau or household as possible terms, and in some ways of talking about families, they may be good terms to use. But there's always a danger that we misappropriate a term like whānau, and household may or may not fit so well for people who are not familiar with some aspects of New Testament teaching on household. Most Christians are discipled within family context. Regeneration tomorrow begins today with family members, children, youth, young adults, parents, and involves grandparents ministering with wisdom and from experience. One reason for focusing on families as a refreshment on raising up young leaders is a recognition through our diocesan ministry team staff that in ways in which shifts are taking place in ministries amongst youth and young adults, we're recognising that we won't have youth from whom to raise up young leaders if we are not attentive to children. We do not have children in church if we don't in some way reach out to the families in which those children reside. So the shift here is not a diminution of our concern to raise up young leaders, but it is a recognition that if we're serious about reaching out into our local neighbourhoods, we need to develop ways and means of reaching to whole families, whatever makeup a whole family has in your neighbourhood today. Families, I think, also is a specific focus on generations in the 0 to 60 age range, though it's not exclusive of those aged 60 and over who are integrated into families, often as very involved grandparents. Communities. The emphasis here is on communities of faith serving local communities. It also tries to capture the sense that to follow Christ as a disciple is always done in the New Testament way of doing it, in communities rather than as discrete individuals. Thinking about communities acknowledges that disciples form faith communities, that faith communities are located somewhere, and thus have a larger local community around them with which to be served in word and deed with gospel motivation. Faith communities, of course, often have lots of satellite communities around them to which they are strongly or weakly connected. Interdependence between communities of faith is to be encouraged. That may be a reaching out and a working together with another local church. It may be working with an intentional neighbourhood community of young people in the midst of your parish. It may be connecting into youth work through 24/7 in a local school and so forth. Within this theme of communities, I envisage us seeking to strengthen local communities taking ownership of their local mission. When communities develop strategy and vision for themselves, they own it and work it out. And within this theme, I think the role of the bishop and of the diocese is to bless the local and to connect the local to the universal. So, finally, we're at the second page of the summary document, the diagram. And what I'm trying to do in putting that diagram to you is to illustrate the following points. that all I'm saying today continues our former strategic concern for Christ-centered mission. So that phrase occurs at the top and bottom of the diagram. That regeneration of the diocese will happen as we focus ourselves, whether we are a ministry unit or a diocesan council or board or the diocesan ministry team or Anglican Care, on one or more of making disciples who make disciples, supporting families, strengthening communities. The circles below the central circle of regeneration acknowledges that regeneration needs resourcing. And so our use of property, the helpfulness of our statutes that we will examine later in the synod, and the application of our finances are part of the resourcing of change in our diocese. And then either side of the word regeneration is an acknowledgement that we are not alone in what we do. We are in partnerships with Tikanga Māori and with other churches. Those other churches are principally the Presbyterian Church, with whom we have some formal cooperating arrangements. But I also think there are significant but non-structured ways in which we are working together with the Roman Catholic Church under Bishop Paul Martin's leadership. In these partnerships, we need to work on them as part of regeneration. And I want to acknowledge Bishop Richard that we're in the early days of working together as two bishops, and we haven't really yet addressed how we might partner one another more. But Bishop Richard and myself are very, very open, under God, in Christ, to working out how a new future for both of us might include a closer cooperation and partnership together. By my watch, we've got 4.5 minutes to go. And I've got about 3 pages. We're doing pretty well, I reckon. I don't necessarily want to, but you may, in your feedback, press us, me, Standing Committee and so forth, to come up with some kind of strategic plan. One reason why I'm not so keen on that is that when we did have a plan about 7 years ago, we never actually adopted it as a synod for one reason or another. And nevertheless, when we kind of used it, we kept veering away from it. And some of what's happened in the diocese since doesn't actually match what we put a lot of time and effort into planning. And so what I want to put forward to you now is something which kind of heads in a strategic direction, but is a bit more about the kinds of things we might say to ourselves about how we would see things being done as we go forward. So this would be what I think would be helpful. As a diocese, when making decisions, we will, one, acknowledge the local is connected to the universal and the universal is made up of the local. We walk and work together, ministry units and diocese, towards regeneration of the ministry units of the diocese. Two, we entrust decision-making within the constraints of civil and canonical law to local faith communities. Three, and this is the most important thing, we ask ourselves whether we're a vestry, standing committee, CPT board, Anglican Care board, diocesan ministry team, other diocesan bodies, what will, when we make a decision, what will make disciples, support families, strengthen communities? Number four, repeat three as we make decisions about personnel, property and planning. Five, we bless thriving local churches and flourishing mission initiatives with practical support, thoughtful encouragement and public acknowledgement. Celebrate success among us, in other words. Six, strengthen weak local churches, but always be willing to make change when after a reasonable time period, strengthening has not yielded flourishing. We may not be able to have 60 flourishing ministry units in 2030. We might be down to 45, even 40, but I'm picking 45. Because in the end, we may have to be that good ecclesiology always faces reality. We may need to make some tough decisions. I acknowledge that. I hope you can too. Seven, we'll acknowledge differences between rural and urban parishes. For example, in respect of differing abilities to maintain property. In the city, it takes a lot of committee work to get the church painted. In the country, the vicar, someone was telling me a story the other day, can be driving by one of his or her churches and see it being painted. So we need to acknowledge that things can happen differently. I want we will acknowledge special situations in the diocese, situations that, in my view, do not necessarily easily fit within any kind of, this is generally the global rule of how we will work. And I want to name the Chatham Islands, the West Coast parishes, Lyttelton and the Mission to Seafarers Ministry for the time being, the Transitional Cathedral, Rolleston as a distinctive housing area, and Hornby Templeton and West Melton in special relationship to development in Wigram. 9, we will offer for a reasonable period intense life support for the parishes most affected by disaffiliations in the past year. We will take account, number 10, of short-term needs over the next 1 to 2 years, medium-term considerations and long-term strategic value. In other words, there may be things we do in the next year or so about decision-making that won't be what we do in 5 years, let alone in 11 years' time, because we need to work with where we're at. Number 11, we'll be open to new arrangements for parishes and archdeaconries so that we support ministry to local communities across the rural districts and urban areas of our diocese. And we are certainly working on ways in which things are going to be different in mid-Canterbury and in North Canterbury as two examples. 12, we'll invite generosity from ministry units as they support other ministry units. That's going to be really important in the next 11 years, that where we can be generous to another ministry unit, we will be so. And yet we'll be open, and we have motions in the Synod, to synodically and consensually determining aspects of resource sharing. We'll encourage 14 new initiatives in ministry and mission and acknowledge the possibility of risk to current ventures when new things happen. 15, we will continue support for and engagement with ministry units which have chaplains, schools, hospitals, residential care facilities, universities, armed forces, emergency responders, the police. 16, we'll favour cooperation where this is either locally desired or become necessary, especially with Presbyterian and Roman Catholic churches, while always supporting identity and strengthening accountability. 17, we will lighten the property portfolio of the diocese which is held in trust by the church property trustees, acknowledging that a regenerating diocese is unlikely to increase the number of administratively minded Anglicans. So we'll lighten the property portfolio by encouraging parishes to reduce their holdings of churches, halls and houses. That is already underway, even in the last year. I mentioned 3 churches for sale, but there are other bits and pieces of property that we're lightening ourselves of, and therefore by 2030 we're on the way to lightening our administrative burden as a diocese. There's a whole section on changing culture in the diocese, which is really important, but I'll leave you to find that on the full online version. Final words. Just after 10:30, I acknowledge I've let you down. Am I dreaming as an offering of fantasy that can never come true? Recently, Teresa and I, along with many others from our diocese, took part in the Abbey, a Tikanga Pākehā youth gathering at Living Springs, 270 young church leaders present, about 95% of whom were actually aged under 30. Being with this lively, energetic, spirit-filled fellowship of present and future leaders of our church showed us that it is not a fantasy to envision a regenerated diocese of Christchurch. So in conclusion, there's so much more to be said, but I must stop here to allow for our discussion and feedback to emerge. We can be regenerated through Christ as a diocese. The pathway I'm charting is along the way of making disciples, supporting families, and strengthening communities. Is it our will together for this to be our vision and our way forward? Thank you for listening. Let's go to morning tea and come back ready to discuss at 11 o'clock.